I know a story, I heard a story of a family who went on a life-changing trip. They left their home and took a flight to northern Pakistan. And northern Pakistan, if you know anything about your geography, which I do because I like geography, but most of you probably won't. I'm one of the sad people who likes looking at maps. Is covered in mountains. And those mountains are part of the Himalayan range of mountains, which are the tallest range of mountains in the world. Okay, and they're the home to the Everest and K2 and all sorts of things. So they arrived, and immediately they were struck by the difference of this location. Because when they got their connecting flight, they went to the desk, and the person behind the desk said, "Well, the connecting flight only flies some of the time." And they said, "Well, why is that? Is it like lack of planes? Is it, you know, pilots? Is it staffing issues?" And they said, no, it's due to weather. Because the mountains are so tall, the plane can't fly over the mountains. It has to fly between the mountains. We can only fly when the clouds have lifted. So fortunately, they only had to wait a day before they got their flight. And it was on a small airplane, and they had, depending on if you like flights or not, a beautiful, wonderful, or frightening experience. Because every time you went through, you basically were going between these huge mountains. Now, if you've been to the Highlands of Scotland, you've seen mountains. But these things make them look like molehills. They are like 10, 20 times bigger. They are massive. And in Scotland, you have these nice sort of rounded mountains. These are fresh, new mountains that have been brought up to the earth. And they are like razors, like sharp and steep. And so going around this plane through these valleys, and the most frightening part of the journey was the pilot said, "Please prepare for landing." Now, normally, if you've been on a flight, you look out the window and you see like fields and maybe a town and possibly even a runway. And they looked out the window and all they could see was massive mountains. And at the bottom of the massive mountains, a ravine and no flat ground at all. And worse than that, it appeared at that point the plane was going to hit into a mountain. But the pilot pulled up. And it appeared for those who were in the plane that the wingtips just missed the side of the mountain by meters. It probably wasn't that much, but it felt like that. And they pulled down, and then they could see this tiny airstrip. And they came down, and they landed very smoothly. And they thought, oh, that's fantastic. And it wasn't until they got, you know when you step off a plane, if you've been on a plane, and you're on the top stairs, it wasn't until they got to the top step they realized just how perilous it was. Because about 100 to 200 meters beyond where the plane had stopped, there was just nothing. Like, the runway just stopped, and there was a 1,000-foot drop into a river below. So you only have one chance of that landing. So with their hearts in their mouths, they got off the plane, and they got little, up there, they have little kind of pickups and little minibuses, and they started their journey on the Karakoram Highway. Now, the Karakoram Highway is one of the highest roads in the world, and it connects Pakistan to China. And you can do that trip. These people were some of the first people to ever do that trip. It just opened. And this road was frightening in itself because it was, again, clinging to the sides of these steep mountains. And at points, it was literally a notch that was cut out of a cliff. And I did a bit of research about this. And apparently the way they constructed this, because this is in the late 80s, they just literally hung men, and life was sadly cheap there, and labor was cheap. They hung men from ropes and gave them a pickaxe, and they just gnawed out bits of the rock until they could get a person onto it, and they could walk in it, and they'd make the notch bigger and bigger until you could fit a car. And every corner you went round, the driver would slow down and look up the hill, because there's landslide risks the whole time. And so you'd stop, you suddenly realize the road was blocked, and you'd either dig your way across the landslide, or you just go back and tell somebody. And they'd bring a digger and they'd open it up. It wasn't tarred and there was no barriers. And you could point, so it was just like a 1,000-foot drop into a river. Eventually they arrived at their destination. Now, as I said, there were some of the first Westerners to go across the Karakoram Highway. And when they got there, the people who lived there, who lived in isolation, never ever left the valley they lived in. These Westerners were like exhibits from a museum or, you know, animals from a zoo. And so this family had the bizarre experience of being followed by a group of children everywhere they went. And sometimes adults would just stop what they're doing and just follow them, just kind of going, look at them. They're very strange. They were very big, the Westerners, in comparison to people who lived up there. The people who lived up there, lived on a very strange diet to our ears, apricot and salted tea. And they follow them around. But as I say, they were much smaller, and they're physiologically designed to live at high altitude. As this family is having a great time, and one day, this family, the father of the family said, you know what we should do? We should go and visit a glacier. If you know anything about geography again, you know all about glaciers. Now I like about glaciers. But essentially what they are is a big chunk of snow that doesn't melt and then forms into a massive ice slug that pours down a mountain. And these big glaciers, like, tear, you know, they create valleys and all this other stuff. But they produce two things, especially in the summer. Number one, they leave behind huge rocks. Another thing they produce is snow melt, like ice melt. Now, this ice melt is filled with sediment, with rubbish. And so it's not like you can put your hand in clear water, but if you put your hand just literally under the water, it would disappear. So there's no tourism at this point. There's no bridges, nothing like that. So they had to hire a guide. So the dad took the oldest two children, who were six and four, and decided to go up towards the glacier. And so as they started going up through the fields, and they got steeper and steeper, and then you'd cross little streams, eventually they reached what would be a large stream. And there was this freezing cold torrent coming down the mountain. And there was no bridge, and the only way to get across was on stepping stones. So the guide went across first, and then the party began to cross. And it was then a tragedy struck, because the older son, who was 6 years old, slipped on one of the stepping stones and fell into the river. Now, incredibly, it was just by chance that the guide was a few steps, meters down the river. He saw it out of the corner of his eye and just instinctively plunged his hand in the water. Now, as I said, you could see nothing. The water was just above freezing. And he just felt something go by, and he grabbed it and pulled this boy out of the water and saved his life. Because there was nobody up there. The river was running faster than you could run, and he was only 6 years old. And I know this story because that boy was me. I was the boy who was pulled out of the river. Now, as a six-year-old, all I remember about the whole experience was being annoyed that my trainers were now wet. And I was sitting on the bank, just going, oh, rubbish. I've got to walk up this mountain with my trainers wet. Fortunately, it was a hot day, and I dried off quickly. Apparently, my dad, he realized immediately just how close it was that he had almost lost me. But being a dad, you can't show that to your six-year-old son. You have to put your game face on. And so I was really keen to just carry on the walk. And so he was like, well, fair enough. So we carried on up, and we got to where these boulders were from the bottom of the glacier. And they are boulders unlike the things you've ever seen. These boulders, I remember them, were the size of houses, like nothing like you've ever seen. And you didn't climb over them, obviously. You climbed around them, or in many cases, under the rocks. And I always thought, when I was 6 years old, I thought, this is what it must be like to be an ant. You know, we see an ant crossing like some big rocks to us. It's like rocks like this big. And it was just incredible. The only disappointment of the journey was that I got to the glacier. It was rubbish. I was 6 years old, and I thought there'd just be this like towering, like, I, you know, white. Yeah. Yvette, do you feel free to close a few of the windows? It's getting a wee bit chilly. I thought it was going to be this towering white cliff that was glowing with, you know, with hues of blue. It was just this big gray lump of ice. Black. And as I thought I could like scoop handfuls of fresh ice and eat it. No, you couldn't do that. So we then saw the glacier and went, oh, that's it. And then we made our way down safely down the mountain. Now, there may be a number of us in this room who could tell of stories of near-death experiences. Maybe in different circumstances, I'd be surprised if anyone had a near-death experience in the Himalayas. I did have an unusual childhood. But nonetheless, we might ourselves or know people who've come to near-death experiences. And Natasha and Denise told of a near-death experience in their life. When Natasha felt the waters fall over her, she felt that she'd fallen into a torrent and could be washed away. And Denise, we heard that powerful testimony, must have felt like my dad sitting powerless on the side. But someone stepped into their life and reached into the torrent, reached into the jaws of death, and pulled Natasha out. And when Mum didn't have the power, this person did. And that person's name, as they said, is Jesus. Jesus is their rescuer. It's incredibly humbling to sit here today thinking there's a man in the Himalayas who's probably about 60, 65, maybe he's even passed away, who I don't know the name of, who rescued me. But we can name this rescuer who stepped into Natasha's life and saved both of them. Many people in this room could tell stories of this rescuer. He's not just a rescuer who steps into our lives, but as we read in Paul's word, he's one that guides us into a new life in a new land. And that's why I continued the story, because this guy took us, he rescued me, and then he guided me. He did not leave me on the mountainside alone. And Jesus does not just rescue us, but he guides us into a new life in a new land. And that's why Natasha and Denise have invited all of us to come today to watch them get baptized. Because they're saying, this is my guide. This Jesus is my rescuer. And they want to make that publicly known to us and to their friends and family. That they're putting Jesus as number one. And they're following him as a guide into new life and new land. Now maybe there's people here who are sitting there thinking, I need rescuing. Or maybe a loved one I know needs rescuing. I thought it was beautiful what Natasha said. It doesn't have to be profound or clever or smart. A one-word prayer is all that Jesus needs to step into our life. And it's of great hope and strength to us, even if we know him, that we can call out with one-word prayers and he steps into our life. But if you don't know this Jesus and you want to know more about him, we would be delighted to tell you our stories of his rescuing in our lives and how Jesus is not just a man who lived 2,000 years ago, but whose life and rescuing and saving power is still at work today and changing our lives and transforming them as we have so powerfully heard this morning.